This is part 11 in the series, The Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America. And it just so happens that this chapter is chapter 11, warmly titled, The Killers Take Over. The Great Depression merely forced the issue, which had been implicit all along in the Germans' philosophy. Economic catastrophe in Germany was in effect the last link in a long chain of ideas and events, and a catalyst which gave Hitler a real opportunity for the final cashing in. The catalyst worked because the nation was already ripe for Hitler's kind of cashing in. If a man long addicted to a toxic drug suffers sudden convulsions and then dies from them, one might validly say that the convulsions were the cause of the death, so long as one remembers the cause of the cause. That same is true of a country addicted to a toxic ideology. For several years after the inflationary debacle, the Republic had seemed to return to normal, enjoying its so-called period of prosperity. It was a shaky, foredoomed prosperity built on credit and quicksands. In essence, Germany's recovery was the result of a massive inflow of foreign, primarily American, capital in the form of huge loans along with large purchases of German securities. America was experiencing the artificial boom of the 20s, a pyramid of highly speculative investments and wild spending made possible by a variety of governmental actions, most notably the action of the Federal Reserve Board in generating a cheap money policy in the banks. The influx of this capital into Germany, which also lacked the free market restraints on inordinate speculation and spending, helped to fuel a similar artificial boom. In particular, the various levels of government in Germany, which had learned nothing and forgotten everything from the inflationary crisis, were once again pouring out money and piling up debts. They were endowing lavish public works, starting a program of unemployment benefits, enlarging the bureaucracy, raising its salaries, and the like. This time, however, the governments were not counting on the printing press to finance their activities, but on the Americans. I must ask you always to remember, said Gustav Stresemann to his countrymen, that during the past years we have been living on borrowed money. If a crisis were to arise and the Americans were to call in their short-term loans, we should be faced with bankruptcy. He said it to deaf ears in 1928. Does that sound like us with China? The ominous parallels. When the New York stock market crash signaled the collapse of the American boom, the collapse of Germany followed immediately as a matter of course. For the second time in less than a decade, a protracted agony struck the country, this time involving plummeting investment, the crash of famous financial houses, cascading bankruptcies, soaring unemployment, tobogganing farm prices, and widespread destitution. The mania of the inflation years had been succeeded by a wave of giddy, unreal prosperity. Now the unreal stood revealed as unreal. Giddiness gave way to panic and to black despair. The philosophical majority among men are the ones most helplessly dependent on their era's dominant ideas. In times of crisis, these men need the guidance of some kind of theory, but being unfamiliar with the field of ideas, they do not know that alternatives to the popular theories are possible. They know only what they have always been taught. When Hans Falada, in his popular novel of the time, asked little man, what now? The little men in Germany, and the other kinds too, knew the answer, which seemed to them self-evident. They turned to the group, to their economic class or trade association, as their only security. Each group blamed the other for the crisis. Each party demanded action, the kind of action it understood, government action, that is, more controls. Man is rotten, the omnipresent chorus of Weimar culture was crying. The individual is helpless. Freedom has failed. The Social Democrats, however, playing out to the end their founding contradiction, were unable to act. One union leader at a party convention indicated the reason eloquently. He asked whether the party at this juncture should strive to preserve the capitalist Weimar system or to topple it. Should socialists stand at the sickbed of capitalism as the doctor who seeks the cure, he wondered, or as joyous heirs who can hardly wait for the end and would even like to help it along with poison? His answer was that the party is condemned to play both roles at once, which in fact is what it did, by switching back and forth at random between them. In the early months of 1930, the nation desperate for leadership, the party stumbled into its totalitarian stance. it decided to bring down a coalition government headed by a social democratic chancellor, Herman Mueller, because of a proposed measure that might have had the effect of reducing unemployment benefits in the future. The Weimar politicians had long been engaged in Kuhhandel, as the Germans called it, cattle trading, and had treated the country to a procession of musical chair coalitions, sudden governmental collapses, and continual new elections. The spectacle had evoked widespread contempt for popular government even before the Depression. After the Mueller cabinet fell on March 27, however, the Black Day of the Republic, no new coalition could be formed. The economic warfare among the parties was too virulent. The Germans' contempt for the Reichstag became disgust. There was only one solution that seemed feasible. On March 28, 1930, the Reichstag's normal legislative prerogatives were suspended by President Hindenburg. A semi-dictatorial system of government, a system of rule by emergency executive decree, was established under Chancellor Heinrich Brunig, a conservative centrist. I'm only laughing because, I mean, if you listen to that again, a system of rule by emergency executive decree. And what have we been under? Emergency war powers since, well, I think in 73, in that white paper by the a Senate subcommittee that Frank Church was on, it said like in 73 that the United States had been under emergency war powers for 40 years. So bring that back to 33, right? That makes sense, the Banking Act and all that. So here we are, what? Some 78 years later, we're still under it. And what's even a greater hoot, if you paid attention to this, not that you should or you shouldn't, but the United States wagged their finger at Mubarak in Egypt for running a state of emergency for 30 years. That's right. He should have been doing this a lot earlier. I mean, who are we to say? That's unbelievable. All right, back to the text. Popular government was abandoned for the duration of the emergency. The dichotomy between political and economic freedom was breaking down by itself without any help from the Nazis. In regard to methods, the Brüning government was dictatorial. In regard to policies, however, it was democratic. The program Brunig and his two short-lived authoritarian successors in 1932 enacted was an exact reflection of the popular will. These men did something in the German sense of the term. The government issued a torrent of new decrees. It raised the tariffs, the taxes, the unemployment insurance premiums. It expanded public works, imposed rigid restrictions on foreign exchange, and introduced a 20-month voluntary labor service for young people, etc. Oh, man. Most important of all, the Reich in this period effectively erased the last significant remnants of private economic power by turning the banks, the cartels, and the labor unions into mere administrative organs of the state. The Republic, writes Gustav Stauffer, a member of the Reichstag at the time, came close to being a thoroughly developed state socialism. Government was omnipresent, and the individual had become used to turning it to it in every need. The government's policies did not work. Among other things, hyper-protectionism in Germany and abroad was strangling the country's vital foreign trade. The cascade of sudden new taxes and emergency decrees was creating a climate of acute business uncertainty, which made impossible any significant recovery of German investment and production. The union's adamant position to further wage cuts was exacerbating the unemployment. The Germans attempted to assess the situation and determine the cause of the government's failure. At last, writes Stolper, and this is a block quote, it became common knowledge that all the state interference was of no avail in the most disastrous economic crisis that had befallen Germany in the course of her history. Paradoxically, the system of state interference, as such, being far too deeply rooted in the German political and economic tradition, was not blamed by the opposition. On the contrary, the general mood of the public backed that the demands that this imperfect and incomplete system of state intervention be superseded by one more perfect and complete. This was the content of the so-called anti-capitalistic yearning, which, according to a national socialist slogan of the time, was said to pervade the German nation. That's the end of the quote. The harbingers of the era to come were the university students. Well before the rest of the country, these young intellectuals turned for guidance to the self-declared Party of Youth, whose leader was promising a revolt of the coming generation against all that was senile and rotten with decay. In the student elections of 1929, the Nazis won a majority or plurality of the vote at 19 universities. Hitler's off-campus support at the time was still insignificant. Many Germans were not yet reconciled to the Nazi manners. The students, however, placed content above form, that is, ideals above social graces. Their ideals were instinct, sacrifice, and hatred. Hatred of the Western enemy and of the bourgeoisie system. One German observer noted in these youths a strange connection between revolutionary mutiny against authority and blind discipline toward the Führer. In fact, the students were mutinying against the Republic not because it stood for overbearing authority in their eyes, but because it stood for freedom. They regarded even some shaky fragments of an individualist way of life as selfish materialism. What they wanted was services to a social cause they could accept as noble, and when they found the cause's spokesman, they were ready to bow obediently. As living standards continued to fall, their parents began a mutiny too. Hitler offered people leadership and an end to class warfare, a final solution to the problems of the mixed economy, and, to each group, his special protection. These were the practical inducements. He also offered what had won the campuses, idealism, as all understood the concept. In the September 1930 Reichstag elections, the first nationwide result of these promises leaped into view. The Nazi vote increased sevenfold to about 6.5 million votes, making the party Germany's second largest after the Social Democrats. According to one study, the party membership in 1930 included, among other groups, blue-collar workers, 28.1%, white-collar workers, 25.6%, self-employed, 20.7%, and farmers, 14%. If any of these Germans wanted to be moral, he was ready to sacrifice himself for the sake of others, and intrigued by a party that loudly demanded this of him. If he wanted to live, it seemed necessary to sacrifice others to his own group by joining a party that loudly promised this to him. If he despaired of either course, he was ready to lash out blindly at fate or at the Jews, and he knew which party felt the same way. The motive might vary, but not the result. It was Hitler for the love in the men, and Hitler for the greed, and Hitler for the hatred. Love, in this context, means Christian love. Greed means the desire to survive in a controlled economy. Hatred means nihilism. In 1930 to 31, pro-Hitler feelings surged higher at the universities. The Nazi totals rose at the University of Munich from 18.4 to 33.3%, at Jena from 3.0 to 66.6, at Erlangen from 51 to 76, and at Breslau from 25.4 to 70.9. The Nazis were winning something like a fifth of the national vote. The students already were largely National Socialists in sympathy. Perhaps half of them were Nazis. Again, as the people grew still more desperate, the country moved to catch up. In the March 1932 election for president, Hitler polled more than 11 million votes. In the July 1932 Reichstag elections, the party doubled its 1930 vote. For the first time, the Nazis were the largest party in Germany. The hours of Weimar, it was widely said, were numbered. The Nazis, however, were far from being a majority. Almost 64% of the votes in July 1932 were cast for non-Nazi candidates. To some Germans, the action to take seemed obvious. If the other parties would only join forces, they said, Hitler, despite his following, could never gain power. The other parties were unable to join forces. Each acted according to its nature and its basic premises. The nationalists, who had long scorned Hitler as a proletarian rowdy, soon discovered his popular appeal and decided to make use of it. In 1929, Alfred Hugenberg had welcomed Hitler onto a prominent committee that he was chairing, designed to fight against the latest reparations plan. For Hitler, writes historian Erich Eck, and this is a block quote, "It was a major triumph to be thus received into proper society. When this mighty leader of the German nationalists accepted Hitler, the man who had previously been rejected and despised by decent people, many Germans felt obliged to take Hitler seriously and to forget his record of misconduct." Thereafter, the nationalists made money available to Hitler, joined with him in a powerful united front, in parentheses, the Harzburg Front of October 1931, and in parentheses, backed him in a presidential runoff election April 1932, and, at the end, were eager to serve in the first Nazi cabinet. "We see in National Socialism the German liberation movement," explained one ardent Lutheran pastor. which we would profess even were it to be led in the name of the devil. Beautiful. It would be quite safe, said Hugenberg, to let Hitler become chancellor, because the cabinet would be filled with traditional conservatives who would keep him in line. In this way, said Hugenberg, we will box Hitler in. Yeah, it worked. The communists, too, wanted to use Hitler. Time after time, their deputies voted with the Nazis in the Reichstag. They voted against legislation designed to cope with emergencies, against measures designed to curb violence, against the attempt to maintain in office any kind of stable government. The communists even agreed to cooperate with Nazi thugs. In November 1932, for instance, the two mortal enemies could be observed standing comfortably shoulder to shoulder on the streets of Berlin, collecting money to support a violent strike by the city's transportation workers. When Hitler's fortune seemed to be faltering for a time in 1932, a stream of anxious Nazis poured into the ranks of the communists. The Germans watching said that a Nazi is like beefsteak, brown on the outside, red on the inside. Soon, however, the traffic was in the opposite direction. There is more that binds us to socialism than separates us from it, said Hitler to Rosning. This is a block quote. There is, above all, genuine revolutionary feeling, which is alive everywhere in Russia except where there are Jewish Marxists. I have always made allowance for this circumstance and given orders that former communists are to be admitted to the party at once. The petit bourgeois, social democrat, and the trade union boss will never make a national socialist, but the communist always will. End of the quote. In the final months, the communists viewed the growing Nazi strength with equanimity. The triumph of Nazism, they said, has been ordained by the dialectic process. Such triumph will lead to the destruction of the republican form of government, which is a necessary stage in the achievement of communism. Afterward, they said, the Nazis will quickly fade and the party of Lenin can take over. In July 1932, despite the machinations of the Nazi nationalist communist axis, the two main Republican parties, the centrists and the Social Democrats, were still holding about 40% of the electorate. The Democrats, having lost their following, were virtually extinct. So was the People's Party. The centrists during the Depression were stressing to the nation's Catholics the urgent need for a moral reawakening to consist of anti-materialism, social consciousness, faith, and discipline. Their party was also seeking an emergency alliance with like-minded groups so as to form a bloc for public order. In this regard, party leaders did not hesitate to be specific. Repeatedly, during 1932, they called for a strong national government in tune with the interests of the people and including the National Socialists. The responsibilities involved in sharing power, the centrists said, would channel the Nazis into more temperate paths and would tame Hitler. The Social Democrats, meanwhile, were being tamed in another way by Chancellor Franz von Papen. In July 1932, using only a token armed force, he ousted them illegally from the government of Prussia. The party leaders understood that this coup, if uncontested, would mean the loss of their last bastion of strength. But they observed the swelling ranks of the Nazis and communists, the Prussian police and the German army brimming with national militants, the millions of unemployed workers which made the prospects for a general strike bleak, and they decided to capitulate without a fight, lest they provoke a bloody civil war they had no heart to wage and little chance to win. There were not many social democrats who rose up in fury over the rape of Prussia. The party had long since lost most of those who take ideas or causes seriously. There was not much youthful ardor to summon to the side of social democracy. Republic, das, oh, I'm not going to read that, it's all German. Anyway, what it means is a republic that is not much, socialism is our goal. Such were the signs carried in parades by young workers of the period. The Republicans from every political party and group were in the same position. More and more, the contradictions involved in their views were leaving these men lifeless and even speechless. They could hardly praise freedom very eloquently, not while they themselves, like everyone else, were insisting on further statist measures to cope with the economic crisis. They could not extol self-government when the Reichstag had just collapsed. They could not affirm even the principle of statism while they were struggling to stave off totalitarianism. To the last-ditch spokesmen of Weimar, from whatever party they hailed, political ideas as such became an embarrassment. Theory was not a means of enlisting support or aiding their cause, but a threat to it. The solution of most such men was to counsel practicality while dismissing abstractions, that is, to turn pragmatist and become enemies of ideology. We must get away from the unfruitful controversy over the terms capitalism and socialism, said Chancellor von Papen in a July 1932 radio address designed to rally the country. Instead, he said, Germany should be guided by a moral principle. General utility comes before individual utility. The principle is right, answered the Nazis, and it means the end of the Republic. On December 15, General Kurt von Schleicher, the last pre-Nazi chancellor, delivered his version of anti-ideology. He explained in a fireside broadcast that he was the supporter neither of capitalism nor of socialism, and that to him, concepts such as private economy or planned economy have lost their terrors. His principal task, he said, was to provide work for the unemployed and get the country back on its economic feet. It's our task, too, answered the Nazis, but a drastic problem requires a drastic solution. The spokesmen of Weimar had no answers. They could not set aside lesser differences and unite in the name of an overriding political principle. Having rejected ideology, they acknowledged no such principle. They could not suggest any alternative to the Nazi plan for a Führer state. They had no definite idea to communicate, except the gingerly fear of definite ideas. The totalitarians knew what they stood for. The non-totalitarians stood for nothing, and everyone knew it. Democracy has no convictions, sneered one of the Nazis. Genuine convictions, I mean, for which people would be willing to stake their lives. The symptoms of the end were the messiahs preaching God to wild-eyed mobs, the bookstores flaunting titles such as The Whip and Sexuality, Massage Institutes, Sappho and Lesbos. Great. The promiscuity, the nudism, the orgies, the cocaine and opium addiction, the venomous xenophobia and anti-Semitism. Still more eloquent was the collapse of the universities and its corollary, the murder in the streets. The Weimar students practiced everything they had learned, believing that objectivity is impossible. They did not try to reason about political questions. Believing that a man is nothing in the face of the community, they did not concern themselves with an opponent's individual rights. Committed to action based on feeling, they responded to disagreement by stopping their fury. The students launched violent mass demonstrations on campus. They invaded the classes of unpopular professors. They gathered in jeering mobs outside lecture halls. They rushed hotly into the head-smashing brawls, and they coolly instigated bloody riots, both of which soon became routine at the German universities. When the defenders of one besieged professor appealed to the authorities for help, the Prussian Minister of Education, a social democrat, and this is a block quote, and I'll have to go find the attribution. But anyway, this Prussian Minister of Education promised that he would not give in, that the professor had the full protection of the government. The excited students committed excesses in the lecture building, prevented students who wanted to attend from coming to classes by bodily force, and got away with it. The professor was given leave of absence for an indefinite time. The students had wanted to stand up for him, were threatened and ill-treated. And then a quote is attributed to Suzanne C. Engelmann, German Education and Re-Education, New York, International Universities Press, 1945. All right, back to the text. The student rebels defended their actions by claiming that the universities must serve the people and therefore must be transformed into agents of revolution. The rebels dismissed the view that a university should uphold freedom of thought. They rejected free thought. Fundamentally, they rejected it on the grounds that thought as such is a waste of time. The universities could not survive the assault for long. They bowed to the rebels' demands. They ceased being centers of learning during the Weimar years. The agent of enslavement had not been Hitler, but their own students. The faculties, the administrations, the authorities, and the press explained to the country that the universities were not enslaved and that the students were victims. I remember Germany and Austria in the late 20s and early 30s, writes an American who served in the U.S. Embassy in Austria. The idealistic youth broke up classrooms, invaded university campuses, broke shop windows. The liberals of Berlin and Vienna sprang to the defense of the youth. They labeled any police action against them as brutality. One of the phrases used to describe the idealistic German youth by editorial writers and educators, believe it or not, was, quote, the culturally deprived. That rings a bell. When they broke windows of Jewish shops, the liberals, even intellectual Jews of Germany and Austria, said, how else shall they show their resentment? Most of the shops just happen to be owned by Jews. That's the end of that quote from the American youth. Hitler was soon equipped to show his resentment, too. In 1930, the SA had numbered upwards of 60,000 men. A year later, it had grown to about 170,000 men. By late 1932, it reached at least 400,000. Increasingly, especially at election times, savage physical battles erupted throughout the country between young Nazis and young communists. The weapons used ranged from fists and knives to grenades and bombs. The toll of dead and wounded became a commonplace, which was reported by the press in the manner of automobile accidents or the weather. Many Germans begged the government to restore order. The student rebels and their professorial defenders had, however, been a microcosm. The new youth are saturated with hatred. Heinrich Mann had observed as early as 1922, here's the block quote, "But the older generation has a bad conscience and never punishes them. All protests, all threats and actions of the young are directed against the older generation and its way of life. The old note all this carefully and give them even more freedom of action. If shots are fired, they frown and wait for the next shooting. They go to the theater and warmly applaud the plays about the most popular of subjects, parricide." That was the end of the quote. Back to the text. The older generation, liberal and conservative alike, was squirming with guilt. It was disarmed by the fact that, while it disapproved of the street thugs' actions, it agreed with all their basic premises and ideals. The Social Democrats had opposed the communists in the post-war upheavals, but had been, and still were, loath to confront or denounce them. Now, the law-abiding rightists were caught, too. Though they actively disliked the gangs of idle, brawling stormtroopers, they were unable to condemn or resist men whom they themselves regarded as idealists. The anti-war movie, All Quiet on the Western Front, opened in Berlin in December 1930. The Nazis, making it a test case, demanded that the movie be withdrawn. Gangs of hoodlums invaded the theater, set off stink bombs, let mice loose among the audience, and threatened patrons with bodily harm. The government decided to restore peace by banning the movie. In April 1932, beset by demands that the violence be stopped, the government imposed a ban on the SA and SS. But on June 15, after a deal between Chancellor von Papen and Hitler, who promised his toleration of the latest cabinet, the ban was lifted. A block quote. "A wave of political violence and murder such as even Germany had not previously seen immediately followed. In Prussia alone, between June 1 and 20, there were 461 pitched battles in the street, which cost 82 lives and seriously wounded 400 men." And that quote comes from William Shirer's work, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Back to the text. On August 9, 1932, the government decreed the death penalty for those convicted of political murder. The next night, a band of Nazis invaded the home of a communist worker in the Silesian village of Potempa and stamped him to death, kicking his larynx to pieces. When the killers were arrested, tried, and sentenced in accordance with the new law, Hitler responded with threats and demonstrations. On September 2, the government gave its answer. The death sentences were commuted to life imprisonment. In parentheses, the killers were freed by Hitler the next year. End of parentheses. The civilized men in the country did not know what to do. In the words of one historian, the moderates voiced desperate appeals to reason, but their techniques were distinctly out of tune with the wild emotionalism that seemed to have gripped a large part of the nation. The civility cherished by the civilized men had finally been defeated by their ideas, although they did not know that this was the cause. After years of preaching contradictions and of evading principles with an anti-ideological shrug, these men were astonished to see the nation conclude that man cannot live by principles, that reason is no guide to action, and that anything goes. After years of institutionalizing interest group warfare, which they had justified as sacrifice or collective service, these men were astonished to see how hostile gangs take to the streets and demand one another's sacrifice. After years of undercutting the mind by preaching the primacy of gentle feeling, in parentheses, whether progressive or religious or skeptical, end of parentheses, these men were astonished to find that irrational feeling is no counter to wild emotionalism. After years of spreading or condoning or subsidizing the cult and culture of nihilism, the civilized men were astonished to find that they had nothing more to say and that there was no one left to listen. The moderates were helpless. The authorities were helpless. The killers were taking over. On January 30, 1933, after due attention to every requirement of German law and of the Weimar Constitution, the Nazi rule was made official. The Weimar Kulturati could not, they said, endure the 19th century world, but they could triumph over it. Within their own sphere, they could act like the god of an ancient legend, in reverse. When they had extinguished the stars and the earth was once again without form and void, when they had remade the living soul of men in their image after their likenesses, when they had breathed into his nostrils the breath of anti-life, when they saw everything that they had made, and behold, it was ruins. Ruins and astrology and word salads and toilet training and diseased lungs. Then they knew that their triumph had been completed, and they were prepared to rest from all their work. When the seventh day came, however, they found that something inexplicable had grown up in their garden of ruins. At first, they could hear only distant howls and approaching steps. It took a while before they were able to see the thing, but at last they recognized the face of Adolf Hitler.